Okay. So what I'd like to do now is open the floor to some questions. So either you can ask questions at the mic, or some people might feel more comfortable writing your questions down and passing them up. So however you prefer to do that. Okay, so one question says, if the parents are very attached to their children, would this hinder their spiritual growth? What could the children do to be able to truly free themselves without hurting their parents? The parents being attached to the children doesn't necessarily hinder the children's spiritual growth. It hinders the parents' spiritual growth. Okay? Because whenever we have attachment, we're boxing ourselves in. Okay? How could the children free themselves without hurting their parents? They have to free their mind from feeling guilty about, you know, their parents. Yeah. What your parents say and do isn't really the thing that has to be changed. What has to be changed is how we react to what our parents say and do. Okay? And so the more that we feel guilty or confused or whatever, then the more we're hooked into the whole thing. But the more we can just let go and be kind to our parents without expecting anything in return, then I think the better the relationship's going to go. Okay, then we know the importance of patience. If, for instance, at work we come across somebody who's extremely impatient and demanding, what could we do? Of course, we always talk about the other person who's extremely impatient and demanding. The question never says, you know, what do I do when I'm impatient and demanding and other people can't stand to work with me? We never think like that. It's always their fault. They're, you know, I have a friend who is, he does, you know, a mediation and conflict resolution, and he does these workshops, and he tells me, because he has this little form that he, you know, has people fill out who come to the workshops, you know, that evaluate, you know, your role in a conflict versus the other person's role in the conflict. And he always says that he gets the people who are the cooperative people in the conflict. You know, they all come to his seminar. But all the people who are stubborn and obnoxious and uncooperative, they're not the ones who come to his seminar. He says, gee, that's so interesting, you know. It's always the other people's fault when there's conflict. Imagine that. Okay, anyway, so at work, somebody who is impatient and demanding, smile at him. Why not? Yeah, joke with them. Do something to relax them. See what it is that they're really asking. You know, what are they really afraid about? What are they really concerned about? Yeah, try and see what is motivating their impatience and their being demanding. Because sometimes if you can get them to talk, or sometimes if you can see what's motivating them, then you can act accordingly. Or sometimes when they have an opportunity to express themselves, they relax. Okay. So I think humor often helps. You know, being kind and smiling often helps. Not taking what they say to you personally is very helpful. Yeah. Because you see, for there to build up a lot of tightness and stickiness in a relationship, two people have to be involved in the conflict. If you refuse to fight and you refuse to be hostile, there's not going to be a conflict. Okay? That doesn't mean that you have to go along with what the other person wants. You can still express yourself, but you know, don't have to be hostile and uptight about it.
Before these questions are passed to you, there's one that was asked to convey to you. Can you talk about homosexuality?
I'd like to stay on the topic tonight. Was it somebody's question? Okay. Can I talk about homosexuality? Some people are gay and some people are straight, and who cares? That's all I have to say. Okay, does karma play a part in our getting angry in some situations? Yeah, karma can play a part. Because why do we find ourselves in difficult situations? Because of actions that we did in the past. Okay? So if we, you know, did things with a crooked motivation in the past, or we did something harmful in the past, we will find ourselves in uncomfortable, unpleasant situations this lifetime. And, you know, then we find ourselves easily getting angry. So actually, sometimes it's quite helpful if instead of getting angry, we sit and think, you know, where did the situation originate from? It originated because of the actions I did, motivated by my own self-preoccupation in previous lives. If I don't like this experience right now, then I better not create the cause for it again, and so I better stop harming other people. Okay? So if we understand karma, then instead of getting mad at other people when they do things, we'll realize that we played a part in the evolution of the event. Okay. So if all of a sudden, out of nowhere, somebody comes and does something really nasty to you, instead of saying, oh, it's all them, recognize, you know, well, have I ever done anything nasty to anybody else? For example, anybody here in this room who's never deliberately hurt somebody else's feelings? We all have, haven't we? Quite deliberately said mean, nasty, cruel things to other people. We've all done it. So is it any wonder that once in a while we get criticized? You know? We've created the cause for it. When we say nasty, mean things to other people or behind other people's back, we're creating the cause for similar things to happen to ourselves. So when they happen to us, rather than get angry about them and blame the other person, let's say, you know, I did it by my own, you know, stupid actions. And so instead of gossiping behind other people's backs or, you know, dumping my anger on them in front of them, I've got to find a way to deal with things better so that I treat other people better so that I'll have happier situations. Okay? So actually understanding karma can help us prevent getting angry in many situations. Okay. I discovered that I always get angry with my girlfriend, as I always find her not trusting me. For example, her past photos. How can I overcome it? Those photos, my goodness, you know. Who cares who she was with 5 years ago? Yeah? I mean, I think it sounds a little bit to me like jealousy. Jealousy and anger are related. Yeah? We're jealous because we're afraid somebody else is going to have happiness that we're going to be left out of. I think rather than... And the thing is that when you're jealous and you kind of get demanding of the other person or suspicious of them, that makes them want to be with you less. You know, because who likes somebody who's, you know, kind of possessive? So what I would suggest is, I think, being a little bit more confident in yourself and recognizing that, you know, you have the causes of happiness within yourself. You can be kind to yourself, be kind to your girlfriend, be kind to everybody else. You know, you also don't need your girlfriend to be happy. You can be happy with her and without her. No? And so instead of clinging on to one person because you've exaggerated that person's good qualities, you know, try and just see them as a human being that you want to nurture and who can nurture you too, and try and create a healthy relationship. Because holding on to the person in a very possessive way isn't going to work. Okay? So I think sometimes that comes because we lack confidence in ourselves. If we recognize that we have some good qualities, you know, and if we recognize that we can be happy, that the potential for happiness exists within us, whether that person's there or not, then our mind relaxes a little bit. Yeah? And anyway, okay, she had her photograph taken with somebody else a year ago. Who cares? You know, that guy's nowhere around. And if, even if he is, you know, so what? Okay. And even if she runs off with him instead of with you, then it's okay. You know? Because do you think they're going to have a perfect relationship? Does anybody ever have a perfect relationship? You know, then instead of you fighting with her, he fights with her. It's okay. Okay. So somebody says every male Singaporean reaching the age of 18 is required to enlist for national service. They will then be trained to defend the country. Young men, Christians, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, through their participation, indicate their willingness to defend their country and their loved ones. They indicate their willingness to kill the enemy if it comes to that. I seriously wonder how many are truly willing to kill or are able to face the consequences of the act. Your advice, please, for the unfortunate young men who may one day be asked to do their duty by killing. I have a lot of sympathy for that question. I mentioned last night that I've been going to Israel to teach. Now, in Israel, not only all the young men at 18 go in the army for 2 years, but also the women have to go in the army. Everyone goes in the army, okay? And after the army, and in Israel, it's very different than in Singapore. I mean, Singapore lives peacefully. If you are in the army in Israel, there is a very real chance that you're going to have to kill or you're going to be killed. And it is an excruciating emotional thing for the young people, and nobody there teaches them how to handle that. You know, at age 18, well, at any age, you know, are we really emotionally equipped to kill another living being? No? Are we equipped to know how to handle those situations? Are we equipped to understand the violence within ourselves that can easily arise at a certain moment? You know, nobody in the army teaches the young people how to deal with those emotions and those situations. And as a result, what I've noticed, because a lot of the young Israelis, after they get out of the army, they come to the meditation courses. You know? And I hear incredible stories from them, and the harm that has been done to them emotionally and spiritually, you know, because nobody has helped them process their experience of being in the army. You know? So, you know, it's similar here, but Singapore, fortunately, is a very peaceful place, and you know, nobody has been in that situation where they have to kill. What one of my students told me when he was in the NS, because we have this thing in Buddhism of seeing that our real enemy is our own self-centered thought, our own selfishness, and our real enemy is our ignorance. And so he told me that when he had to do the NS and learn to shoot at targets, instead of thinking the targets were enemies being human beings that he had to kill, he would think of the target as his own ignorance, or his own anger, or his own self-centeredness. And I thought, wow, you know, that was a really good way to kind of transform the military training that he was doing and give it some other twist, some other way to think about it. Mm-hmm. So I think as much as possible, you know, that if people, you know, the people in the country as well as the politicians and the people in the military can find ways to talk about their conflict and prevent conflict, you know, then they won't put their children at age 18 in the situation of having to kill or be killed, which is a terrible situation to put your kids into, you know. I often wonder sometimes if that maybe the politicians who are ordering the troops around should be the ones who go out and fight with each other. Yeah? I mean, they sit nice and comfortably, don't they? And they make the young people go out and kill. You know, maybe they should go do that. But to me, war has always seemed like little kids throwing sand at each other in kindergarten. You know, except instead of throwing sand, they throw bombs. You know, it doesn't make sense to me. So I think, as you know, as much as on an individual level we can work on our anger and prevent conflicts by sharing resources instead of by being stingy, then I think we can hopefully try and avoid these situations. Okay, so I love this person. When something happens to him, for example, he's sick, I worry. Sometimes I wish that we should be able to grow old together. I would like to die before him. Is this attachment? Yes. Am I being selfish? Yes. Okay. Again, you know, what's coming behind this mind is thinking that an external person has the power to bring us happiness. Okay. Now, if somebody came up to you and said, I expect you to always tune into how I'm feeling, to always support me from when I'm down, when I'm in a good mood, I expect you always to be in a good mood, when I'm in a bad mood, I expect you to pull me out of my bad mood, I expect you always to be kind to me, always to take care of me, to be interested in the same things that I'm interested in, to want to eat the same kind of food that I want to eat, when I want to eat it. You know, if somebody said this to you, and they said that they expected you to do this for the rest of your life, what would you say? Hey, you know, give me a break. I'm just a human being. Yeah. But if we look, very often this is what we expect in romantic relationships, is that one single living being should meet all of our needs. That's totally unrealistic. Totally unrealistic. How can one other person meet all of our needs and make us perpetually happy? It's impossible. We can't do that for anybody else. Why do we expect somebody else to do it for us? So I think a lot of times now what's happening is people put too much emphasis on romantic relationships and they neglect the other relationships in their life. And because they think, oh, this one person's going to be it all. But no person can be everything to somebody else. So we need to cultivate multiple relationships. We need to cultivate relationships with people who are older than us, with our parents, with our aunts and our uncles and our brothers and sisters and cousins and co-workers and friends and children and the children of our neighbors and our nieces and our nephews. And we need many different kinds of relationships, not just one romantic relationship. Okay, why? Because we have different needs, different characteristics, and different people are going to bring out different things in us. If we expect one person to do it all, we're going to have a miserable marriage. You know, but if we have a diversity of relationships and we let our partner have a diversity of relationships, then your marriage is going to be much stronger, because when you come together, you're going to really have a good time instead of being so demanding upon each other. Okay? How can we help somebody who has shut herself off from the rest of the world and is constantly angry with those around her? Smile. You know, until that person decides that they want to change, there's not a whole lot you can do except just be patient with them and not box them in more. You know, sometimes if you go to a person and say, you know, you're always in such a bad mood, it's really bumming me out and you've got to change your mood. You know, we're being demanding. If somebody is like so miserable inside, sometimes they might need to go to the doctor because there might be, you know, some physiological thing going on. Sometimes they may need to go for counseling. You can encourage them, but you can't force them to do it. And sometimes you just have to kind of be patient and wait and be a little bit easygoing and give them some space until they come to the conclusion that they're miserable and they want to change. Yeah, but until somebody inside themselves decides they want to change, you know, you can do 10 backflips and a double somersault and it's not going to change a whole lot. Okay? Is it okay to show anger with a good motivation? For example, teaching the children a good lesson. If it's okay, how can it be done tactfully? I don't think it's a question of showing your anger. What you want to do is, if you have a kind motivation, you can sometimes act very forcefully because you know it's the only way to communicate with somebody else. But inside, your mind's not angry, your mind's calm. Okay? So for example, if you have a 3-year-old child who starts wandering out towards the PIE to go play, okay, if you just go up and pick them up and say, "You know, this isn't such a good place to play, really, you know, come inside," your kid's not going to listen. Yeah, because they're too absorbed what they're doing. If you pick them up and you look at them and you said, "Don't do that, it's dangerous," they're going to wake up and hear you. Okay? So sometimes with very young children or certain people in certain situations, you have to be really strong outside. But you do that with a compassionate motivation. Okay? Because you know that that's the skillful way to communicate with them. How do you keep your patience with someone who drinks a lot and refuses to change? Don't cooperate with their drinking. You know? Tell them, if you drink, it's your responsibility. Don't drag me into it. Yeah? So don't cover up for them. Yeah? Don't go along with their drinking. Don't cover up for them. Don't make excuses for them. Don't clean up after them. You know? They're responsible for what they're doing. Okay, how do you deal with a person who is manic depressive? How do you help that person? That's difficult, you know, it's hard. In the case of somebody being manic depressive, sometimes, very often actually, there is a chemical imbalance in the brain. And if that person can get proper medication, very often the condition can improve. So you might have to really talk with the person and convince them to go to a doctor and, you know, get proper treatment. But don't rely just on medicine to make the situation better. I think counseling and therapy can also be effective together with the medication. And you know what they found out recently in the case of depression? That if people get a lot of exercise, the depression heals quicker and is less likely to recur. Isn't that interesting? You know, if people get exercise, I know this is like Singaporeans don't believe in exercise. You know, I've noticed this, you know, people say, "Oh, you know, they have to drop you off right in front of something because, you know, if you walk 3 steps instead of 2 steps, you might fall over in exhaustion." Yeah. But really, exercise is very good for you, and it's very helpful for conditions like depression. Mm-hmm. And I think if you're living with somebody who's manic depressive, one of the things that's very important for you to do is to be stable yourself and not let that person's condition control your life. You know, you have your own life, you have to live your own life, you try and help them as much as possible, but don't make it so that your whole life revolves around that person, because then you're going to get tangled up as well as them being tangled up. So try and help them get the help they need, you know, and support them in their recovery, but don't get dragged into it. How do you make a person whose motivation is self-interest see themselves? You mean how, when somebody else is being selfish, do I make them see that they, instead of being selfish, should be nice to me? Is that what the question's saying? I think the thing always is to ask ourselves, when am I working out of self-interest? I mean, the Buddha said something, I'm very bad at exact quotes, but you know, instead of looking at what others have done and left undone, we need to look at ourselves and what we've done and left undone. And if we spend more time looking at our own faults and correcting them, we're not going to have so much time to get all upset and depressed about other people's faults. Okay? So I think the basic thing is, instead of wanting to cure everybody else of their selfishness, to look at our selfishness that wants them to stop being selfish. Okay? Yeah? And of course, sometimes if it's a very close friend, You know, sometimes you can point something out to them in a kind way and they can see it and accept it. I mean, it's a thing of developing skill in working with people so that you can give them feedback. Or better yet, the best thing to do is to ask them questions so that they can explore and find the answers themselves. Because if you go to somebody and say, you're selfish, who's going to say you're right? You know? I mean, everybody says, no, I'm not. But if you give somebody questions to think about and reflect on, they may, by their own, you know, self, come to the conclusion that they're putting a little bit too much emphasis on their self and that they would be happier if they were more open to other people. But like I said, you know, special thing is we've got to look at ourself. Okay. Understanding that your actions might affect your future life might not motivate some people to perform good deeds because they might not care what happens in the future life or the next life. Can you comment? Okay, well, if people don't believe in future lives, then of course they're not going to be interested in preparing for future lives. Okay? So still, within, you know, if somebody feels that way, still they can see that their attitudes and actions create suffering for themselves and the people around themselves in this life. And that alone can often, you know, motivate us to change. If somebody really believes in future lives, then, you know, it does create a motivating factor to look at what we're saying and thinking and doing. Now people say, well, why should we care about future lives? Well, for the same reason you care about old age. Except that, you know, your old age is not certain, but your future life is. Yeah. Because we might not live to be old. It's true, isn't it? Yet we do a lot of preparation for our old age. You know, we save money and we do this and that, put everything in order, but we might die before we get to use all of it. Yeah. But future lives, for sure, are something that are going to happen. And so if we're concerned about that, then, you know, we make preparation for future lives. How do we do that? We start doing harmful actions and we do positive actions. So you're asking what to do when people try and convert you and when they're being pushy about it. Yeah? Okay. You know, I have this situation sometimes of it happening in America. People will go door to door, you know, and knock on your door and want to tell you the good news. And and so what I do, and I do this with all sincerity, is I open the door and I say, you know, thank you, I'm a Buddhist. I'm very firm in my own Buddhist beliefs. Jesus said some very good things about developing love and compassion and patience. And I think if you follow his teachings, you'll be happy. And that's what I say to them. And that's it. Okay? So I don't think that there's any need to debate religion. No? If somebody is trying to convert you and you're not interested, just do not engage in the conversation. That's it. Yeah? You don't need to refute what they're saying. You don't need to go along to their activities if you don't want to go. You just say, thank you, but I'm not interested. That's it. That's all you need to do. It's not a thing of slapping somebody. You're just being very firm in what you believe and you're firm in what you want to do, and that's it. You're not insulting to them, but you're not cooperating with them and doing something that you don't want to do. Okay? You just be very firm, that's it. Yeah? And like I say, I mean, it's ridiculous to debate religion with somebody who's trying to convert you because they're not interested in discussion. Yeah? Actually, what I would like to see, what I think is very important in Singapore, is more genuine interreligious dialogue where people really listen to each other and really share with a kind heart instead of seeing it as a debate to get more people on their football team. Yeah? But to have genuine, you know, respectful dialogue. I do this a lot in the States, and also when I was in Israel, I meet people from different religions and I talk with them, and I learned a tremendous amount from them, you know. But it has to be with people who are secure in their own religious beliefs. Because when they're secure in their when people are secure in their religious beliefs, they don't have to prove themselves to anybody else by trying to convert other people. Okay? And they can genuinely engage in dialogue, and that creates a very good feeling, and people can really learn, you know. And there's a lot, I think, that people from different religions can learn from each other that will enhance their own faiths. But making religion into a competition, no? Or making it into a thing to win more members, or to get people to believe what you believe so that you can feel that what you believe is right? That's not the purpose of religion. Yeah, religion is not something to fight over. It's something to use to tame your own mind. So I think if you're around people who see it in other ways, you just don't engage. That's all. There's no sense in getting caught up with it. Okay, so today we have cloning on organ research on animals. What's your opinion? You know, or what's it going to be like when it comes to human? Will these cloned human beings be no self? You know, have less, be lesser in intellect, not have human feelings, etc. You know, I see the whole thing of cloning as an expression of our egocentrism. You know, I want somebody who looks exactly like me. Yeah. Huh? If we succeed, I mean, any living being that's cloned has a different consciousness. Okay? So if you clone yourself, it's not going to be a replica of you. It's going to be a different living being. You know, and we think, oh, well, I'll clone myself, and then if I need a new kidney or liver, I'll get it from that person. Well, you know, they might think the same thing about our kidney and liver. So, you know, we have to recognize that these are separate individual mind streams, and, you know, they're other living beings. And that's why I would really suggest in scientific research and medical research that people really think a lot about the ethical consequences of the research they're doing before they do the research, you know, because it would save a lot of human suffering.